the West is not of its mind. What they're doing is that if we can't have Ethiopia, Eritrea, the Horn of Africa, what we're going to do is we're going to destabilize this entire region.
Today on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Well, we don't have a land army to work with there in Ethiopia that I'm aware of.
Unless it's the TPLF.
You are right. We could decide to break up Ethiopia. Right. We decided to break up Yugoslavia. We decided to break up Libya. We decided to break up Syria. We could make a strategic decision to break up Ethiopia. Right. That could happen. I think it would be a disaster.
Today we consider heightening tensions and the U.S. insistence on global hegemony as manifest in the Horn of Africa, and particularly Ethiopia, a nation of 117 million people, the second most populous on the continent, with one of its fastest growing economies. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica and its radio affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Ethiopia is the center of the Horn, bordered by the smaller nations Eritrea, Djibouti, and Somalia to the east, Kenya to the south, and Sudan to the west. Its stability is essential to that of the Horn and the wider region. From 1991 to 2018, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, tyrannized the Ethiopian people, practicing a divide-and-rule strategy of ethnic division, competition, and polarization that included ethnic identity cards and ethno-linguistic states. At the same time, the TPLF served as a key U.S. military partner and proxy, most notably by invading and destabilizing Somalia, but also by dispatching troops as needed by AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. The TPLF was finally ousted by a popular uprising that brought Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to power in 2018. And a year later, Prime Minister Abiy won the Nobel Prize for negotiating peace in a long-standing border conflict with neighboring Eritrea. But the U.S. foreign policy establishment missed its former regional proxy, and lo and behold, its former proxy attacked a federal army base in Tigray, its own 6% ethno-linguistic base, on November 3, 2020. Prime Minister Abiy responded, as any sovereign head of state would, by sending federal troops into Tigray, where a civil conflict ensued for 8 months leading up to the current uneasy ceasefire. Some have called this a secessionist war, and the TPLF sometimes suggests that they plan to secede, but Article 39 of the Ethiopian Constitution, which the TPLF largely wrote, grants any of Ethiopia's 9 ethno-linguistic states the right to secede by following legislative and referendum procedures that don't include attacking a federal army base. Throughout the conflict, Western press and officials have characterized the TPLF and the Tigrayan people as victims of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, and rallied support for humanitarian intervention, even though their former proxy, the TPLF, started the war. I spoke to legal scholar and University of Illinois law professor Francis A. Boyle about Ethiopia and international law. On the UN Security Council, they've considered this a number of times with the same result. Russia, China, India, and Kenya speak up for Ethiopia's sovereignty, say that this is an internal matter.
So far, their statements are correct. This is an internal armed conflict, as far as I can see.
Well, on the other side of the aisle, the other three nations with veto power, the US, UK, and France, and their allies, are constantly raising humanitarian alarm and seeming to suggest that some sort of intervention to protect the people of Tigray is going to be necessary. And Secretary of State Blinken has made the ominous warnings that if the Ethiopian government doesn't do this or that in respect of humanitarian concerns, there will be grave consequences. There are already sanctions on specific leaders, not on the people. And no one is more adamant about all this than Samantha Power,
power. Now she's head of USAID, which we all know is a front organization for the Central Intelligence Agency. But unfortunately, she also sits on Biden's National Security Council. And she's just a rabid warmonger. She was behind convincing Obama to destroy Libya, along with Mrs. Clinton. And Anne-Marie slaughtered the head of the State Department policy planning staff again, and Susan Rice, the National Security Council advisor for Obama. But they did the same thing on Libya. They did the same thing on Syria, invoking humanitarian law. So it's the same method of operation. All these Bidenites used to work for Obama, including Biden. So, yes, this is a dangerous situation if they're going to push for some type of military humanitarian intervention. So those statements by Biden and Sam, our problem from hell power, they don't help anything at all. I think that certainly the Russians and the Chinese would veto any type of Security Council resolution authorizing military force under these circumstances.
The humanitarian interventionist gang haven't been able to get the responsibility to protect doctrine incorporated into the UN Charter, have they?
No, it's not in the UN Charter. And as a matter of fact, what happened was this. Historically, when Clinton bombed Serbia over Kosovo, they had NATO. NATO was us. They tried to sell it on grounds of humanitarian intervention. No one bought that argument. So then they tried to come up with a new euphemism for humanitarian intervention, old wine in a new bottle. So they called it responsibility to protect. Well, if you go back and read the author of Responsibility to Protect, Gareth Evans and others, the criteria they establish contradicts the UN Charter on the threat and use of force and substitutes for the United Nations Charter rules on the threat and use of force the Christian doctrine of a just war. Now, think about that for a minute. The Christian doctrine of the just war? That goes back to St. Augustine. I teach a course on jurisprudence, the philosophy of law, and I lecture my law students on the Christian doctrine of a just war. Well, that's why we have the United Nations Charter, because every state in the world today has agreed upon the rules of the United Nations Charter, and they certainly have not agreed upon the Christian doctrine of just war. Second, well, okay, so we're arguing for the Christian doctrine of just war. Well, okay, what about the Hindu doctrine of the just war or the Hebrew doctrine of the just war, which the Israeli government likes to apply all the time? God gave us this land. Or what about the Muslim doctrine of just war? Oh, excuse me, that's jihad, which everyone condemns all the time. So the reason we have the UN Charter is to transcend these religious doctrines on one set of rules that we can all agree upon. Obama and power and Rice and slaughtered and Amy Bond, Democracy Now, and Juan Cole at the University of Michigan, yeah, all tried to justify stealing Libya's oil, destroying Libya's estate on the grounds of responsibility to protect humanitarian intervention. The tie-in to the Christian doctrine of just war should give it all away, right? As far as Christians are concerned, any war they ever fought against non-Christians was just. So that doesn't get you anywhere.
I think evil is essentially self-righteous.
And as a matter of fact, the United States government tried to get the UN General Assembly to adopt their doctrine of responsibility to protect. And the UN General Assembly rejected it and said, well, okay, there very well could be genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity going on, but any threat or use of force must be conducted in accordance with the rules of the United Nations Charter. And R2P as a doctrine was just trying to preempt the UN Charter, as Clinton tried to do in Kosovo and Obama's tried to do in both Libya and Syria. Sure, they might try here in Ethiopia, and we have to watch this situation very carefully.
Is there any situation where a determination that genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity were being committed within a nation, but not by an outside aggressor? Is there any situation in accordance with international law where another member nation could go into the nation that is having this trouble?
Again, the United Nations General Assembly considered that issue and said that any threat or use of force still must be subject to the rules of the United Nations Charter on the threat of use of force, because these bogus doctrines like humanitarian intervention, responsibility to protect, intervention, protection, have historically been used by powerful military states in Europe, the United States, certainly, to intervene into third world countries primarily inhabited by people of color. I mean, there's a racial and religious component here, too. It's an extremely dangerous doctrine. And let me put it conversely, Anne, as I point out in my book, is anyone talking about humanitarian intervention or responsibility to protect the Palestinians from what Israel is doing to the Palestinians? Of course not. It just proves to you the hypocrisy of the entire doctrine.
Well, and there are well over 500,000 homeless people in the United States. 40% of them are black. 34% of the prisoners in the enormous U.S. gulag are black. Nobody's daring to say they're going to intervene, invoking the responsibility to protect doctrine here.
As I point out in my book, and I go through all the historical examples going back to the 19th century, where major military powers in Europe and then the United States used these types of doctrines to justify military intervention into third world areas, people of color, in order to steal their land and their natural resources. So they're not entitled to any respect at all under the United Nations Charter.
There's no doubt that people do horrendous things to one another. Atrocities are committed, including those here in the U.S. But according to international law, as long as atrocities are being committed or there's a struggle within the boundaries of a member state, that member state has to deal with it and no other member state has the right to intervene.
Not unilateral intervention, correct. But if there are massive atrocities, indeed, that's what the UN General has said, that if you have war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide going on in a country, the Security Council should deal with it. And the Security Council does have authority to deal with it on grounds of a threat to the peace. If you read Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, it says that the Security Council has authority to deal with breaches of peace, acts of aggression, or threats to the peace. Certainly, outright genocide would be a threat to the peace. The Security Council could deal with it if it wants to.
But the Security Council would have to agree that the level of humanitarian crisis rose to the level that called for a UN Security Council intervention, right?
Right.
By intervention, that would mean the UN Security Council would organize some kind of military action.
Or there could be an embargo or an arms embargo, or sanctions or something like that. Yes, but the Security Council members would have to determine that the human rights violations in that state has risen to a point where they constitute a threat to the peace, that is international peace, and then they would have jurisdiction to act, yes. And there are a variety of measures that they can take. I won't go through them all here, but if you read Chapter 6 and Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, and, you know, there have been precedents back and forth. But, you know, this would basically require the five permanent members to sit down and come up with an agreement on how to proceed. And right now, it does not appear that that is, will be the case.
They are deadlocked. The UN Security Council is deadlocked as it was during the Korean War and the Vietnam War. It's now deadlocked on Syria, Venezuela, Ethiopia, and I don't know what else. But that's better than dominance by the United States, which was the case in the 90s.
Well, if the U.S. government were serious, it would try to sit down with Russia and China and come up with measures for the peaceful resolution of this dispute. There is one other mode here. That is, if there is a deadlock at the Security Council and a veto under the Uniting for Peace resolution, it could be turned over to the United Nations General Assembly to deal with. But it's really the Security Council that's supposed to take first crack at it. I don't know if this deadlock so far at the Security Council will hold up. We'll just have to see. I regret to say, Anne, it looks like under Biden, this is a third Clinton term, and we have all the humanitarian warmongers back in power here. So I can't say I'm overly optimistic.
Okay, now you explain all this in much more detail in your book, Destroying Libya and World Order, the three-decade U.S. campaign to terminate the Gaddafi revolution, right?
All the legal arguments are there in my book, and the book was just about Libya, but I also, in the conclusion, extended it to Syria, mm-hmm. as well as the French invasion of Mali. So those were preliminary observations. But most of the book is about Libya and the Obama destruction of Libya as a state. And all this is about stealing Libya's oil, not this humanitarian intervention nonsense. Back in the 1980s, I was in Libya on lecture tours and business and whatever, repeatedly. And what struck me was the Libyans could barely defend themselves. They were sitting on top of all this oil, and they were ripe for the pickings. And sure enough, it was Obama that pulled the trigger on them.
You mean they were ripe for the pickings because they were right there on the Mediterranean?
Right. NATO forces were right there, and just massive quantities of oil. So, of course, it was going to be stolen at some point.
I believe you said that a U.S.-NATO aerial bombing war in Ethiopia is unlikely because the geography would be so challenging and the refueling issues so complex.
I think it'd be very hard. Though the U.S. does have a drone base in Djibouti, which we have been using to blow up Somalia and in the Sahel. But those are assassination attacks. I don't think a drone war in Ethiopia is going to make a hill of beans difference one way or the other. But that's the closest military base we have there is Djibouti. It would require massive scaling up of Djibouti and other military assets in that region to launch any type of bombing campaign of Ethiopia along the lines of what we did with Libya.
Plus, Syria.
In both Libya and Syria, Obama was using terrorist jihadis as his land armies. Well, we don't have a land army to work with there in Ethiopia that I'm aware of.
Unless it's the TPLF.
You are right. We could decide to break up Ethiopia. Right. We decided to break up Yugoslavia. We decided to break up Libya. We decided to break up Syria. We could make a strategic decision to break up Ethiopia. Right. That could happen. I think it would be a disaster. But who knows with the people Biden have around him.
Okay. Francis Boyle, thank you very much for speaking to COVID, Race, and Democracy.
Well, thanks, Anna. I'm glad we finally made our connection.
Wada damar taxi wacha ye exar vezi samsa somze got me tafar soke somze antar apa soke killa isne killa tike itse wacha songa kar sokte songa sokte nishtagina Gail Baba, Nishtagina, Barger Baba, Nishtagina.
Music by Tariku Gankisi from Ethiopia. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Pacifica's Polina Vasiliev spoke to Eritrean-American Simon Tesfamariam about his new Africa Institute publication, Disinformation in Tigray, Manufacturing Consent for a Secessionist War.
So the current narrative is one where TPLF is portrayed as heroic and as this force for good in the Horn of Africa, and that the Tigrayan people are being targeted by the federal government of Ethiopia and the Eritrean Defense Forces and the Amhara militias located in a neighboring region that have come into Tigray. And so this is not based on evidence. There's the claims of genocide and sexual violence and all these horrific things. And we ask for the evidence. Where's the evidence? And when you look at it, basically this narrative is the singular type of narrative, reductionist narrative, that does support some type of interventionist policies from the West. And so what's actually going on is detailed in that report, and we can talk about that.
When I was reading the report, it really sounded to me like something straight out of the Project for the New American Century neocon operations manual for a dirty war in Syria or an Arab Spring, Gene Sharp-style color revolutions. Is that what's going on?
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on. The nations of Eritrea and Ethiopia and Somalia, I should say, are being targeted right now for regime change. because what's going on is they're moving away from these puppet regimes, Western control. In the case of Eritrea, it had long been outside of Western control, but Ethiopia and Somalia have very exciting leaderships now that are changing this reality and moving in the direction of Eritrea as well. And so you have this Horn of Africa that is collectively aspiring to be sovereign and free, and America, the West, wants to take it back into this arrangement where it's client states that are just doing its bidding and being super exploited for their purposes. And so that day is over, and they're doing everything in their power to reverse this reality. And that's why you're seeing all this disinformation being manufactured, because of the fact that nobody would accept what the United States is doing had they known exactly what was going on. And so they're whipping up this fairy tale of genocide and ethnic cleansing. And this is not to say that atrocities aren't going on, because people are suffering indeed, but who is behind it? What is the cause of this? You have TPLF, which started the war, and you have the United States, which has been backing TPLF for a very, very long time, looting the region of all its resources. And now you have the peoples of the Horn standing up against TPLF. And it's exciting times. And I think people, particularly progressives around the world, should take note of what's going on before they intervene in this region like they did in Syria, Libya, Yugoslavia, and you just go down the list.
And then we heard from Undersecretary of State Tibor Nagy in a U.S. State Department briefing on November 19, 2020, saying, quote, "As I mentioned, we expressed our thanks to Eritrea for not being provoked when they were attacked by missiles, because apparently one of the aims of the TPLF hardcore leadership was to try to internationalize the conflict," end quote. So we're hearing now from the likes of New York Times, BBC, Al Jazeera, that humanitarian access to Tigray is restricted. Is that the case? And if so, who is doing it?
That's the narrative that the Western media is pushing forward without citing any evidence to corroborate such claims. What we know is that the government itself was providing 70% of humanitarian aid funding to the region. And you have WFP on record, the director of that, leader of that, who says that we're making our way into Tigray, and endorsing the fact that the government has been doing a lot to help with aid reaching the region. But we also have to consider the fact that multiple convoys of weapons in NGO trucks and caravans have been caught on record. And we just simply can't ignore that, because TPLF is encircled and they're going to need supply lines. And where are their supply lines going to come from? They're going to need weapons. They had 80% of the weapons at the Northern Command, which they attacked and sought to keep, that were in their possession for a day or two, but were ultimately captured by the federal government. And so without weapons, without medicine, without food, all these things to support their fighters, where is all this stuff going to come from? And the government has actually, despite all of this, given these things to the people, knowing that, of course, some of it may potentially end up in the hands of TPLF fighters, but it has not restricted these things to the people, according to my knowledge. What we do know is that who is actually restricting these things? We have on record TPLF saying it's going to destroy bridges. And in fact, just recently, the Tahuzi Bridge was actually destroyed. And it's funny, the blame immediately went towards the government. But does that make any sense? It wouldn't, because the government itself is currently repairing that bridge. So why would it destroy something and then repair it? It just doesn't make any sense. You also have media that has showed TPLF destroying bridges. There was a VRT News, which is from Holland. You had a reporter who came out there to Tigray and saw that a bridge had been destroyed, and actually blamed TPLF and said they weren't letting humanitarians as well as journalists get onto the other side. So when it comes to actual evidence, you find that TPLF is stopping aid from getting in. Why? Because then what's the narrative going to be? Oh, the government is stopping aid from getting in. It's, you know, creating ethnic genocide. It hates us so much. It hates our people. And we have no choice. We need airdrops. We need a no-fly zone for aid to come in, which in other words is code word for humanitarian intervention, which is code word for war. So we have to be very careful about these narratives that they're pushing forward, just suggesting that aid is being blocked. We need evidence. Show us where it is being blocked. If you think that totally unrestricted, unfiltered aid is going to come in, which includes weapons, potentially very dangerous weapons, the West is out of its mind. there's no problem with aid getting in and access being quote unquote unfettered, the term that they like to use. But if you're talking about unfettered in the sense that military equipment and hardware is going to enter into Tigray, no.
Now, let's figure out who the actors are. The role of the media, there seems to be a whole disinformation network. For instance, talk about the International Crisis Group.
National Crisis Group is a well-known organization in the Horn of Africa. They have done horrible things, said horrible things, written horrible things about the different countries in the region. They've basically stoked chaos in Somalia. I remember personally from my experience about reading about what was going on when TPLF attacked and invaded the Somali people, the Somali nation. ICG said that there were 2,000 Eritrean troops inside of Somalia, and there was just no evidence. There was no proof. And they just ran away with that story and just thought it was okay. And that was back in 2007. And one of the reasons why Eritrea got sanctioned was for involvement in Somalia, and works like the ICG publications by them were cited. And so it has been this organization that's used to target countries and create crises, ironically, instead of solving them, creating them and managing them. And so what they're currently doing with the Tigray conflict is they're doing the same. They created this narrative that TPLF was this battle-hardened group that had 250,000 soldiers, was basically ready for war, emboldening the group to the point where they attacked on November 4th, bragged about it, openly stated they attacked and said that they were going to be going for Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia. They fired missiles on Asmara, Eritrea, forcing Eritreans to respond. And then when they did respond, then you have them crying foul and saying it's genocide against the Tigrayan people. And ICG has been all this while just going along with this narrative, providing the decontextualized sort of analysis of what's going on. And one of their most unsavory characters is William Davison, who actually was based in Addis Ababa and was the lead for the foreign correspondents. He had an organization where he led foreign correspondents there. And eventually got kicked out of the country when the Tigray conflict ensued because of the fact that he was just pushing out so much disinformation and taking a very positive line on TPLF, supporting TPLF, just one of the most sycophantic characters when it comes to TPLF. And in fact, he was liaising with a TPLF office known as the Tigray Friendship Office, headed by Wandimu Asaminu, who is actually a former TPLF ambassador to Somalia. I don't even want to say Ethiopian ambassador because he was truly a TPLF ambassador and would work very closely with General Gabre, which is one of the most hated characters in Somalia. You ask any Somali right now about General Gabre, and they'll tell you horrible things about this TPLF general. And so you had William Davison liaising with this office, and to this day, I believe continues to do so. And so he basically gets the talking points for TPLF and then pushes it in the international media through ICG. They actually create narratives before the facts are there, and then they find the facts, and then the facts get promoted on social media by the same organs, and then it eventually becomes a high-level report, which then is cited by governments to attack Ethiopia and Eritrea. So I really feel that people need to understand this, the distinct stages and steps and how it gets done. At the very start of it, though, is TPLF itself. It briefs its Western contacts, and three that I should name are Mirjam van Rijzen, which uses these things called situation reports from the European External Policy Advisors, which is
Europe
this,
External
like,
Program with Africa, right?
Yeah, yes, something like EPA. EEPA. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they have Martin Plaut, which, oh my goodness, one of the worst of all that I have ever seen on the region.
Martin Plaut is with the Eritrea Hub.
Yes, Eritrea Hub. It's a blog and basically puts all the information out there, and he tweets very actively. He's a former BBC Africa journalist. Calling him a journalist is, the furthest thing from the truth, because he is not a journalist, in my opinion. But that's what his cover was. And then you also have Alex DeWall, who is this go-to expert on all things Africa, particularly focusing on East Africa and the Horn in particular. And Alex DeWall, based at Tufts University, heads the so-called World Peace Foundation, puts out a lot of his information through there. And he is often cited in newspapers, just like Martin Plaut. But they have direct contacts to TPLF members, and they don't hide this fact. They talk about it, particularly Alex DeWall, who claims to get information directly from the TPLF about like ground movements and the war conditions and this and that. And so they create a narrative. They'll write something up, for instance. So With Alex de Wahl, it was famine. He was the head person on the famine issue. With Martin Plaut, it was the, and Mirjam van Rijzen, I should say, with EEPA, you had this creation of the Aksum massacre of supposedly 750 people. This is the problem with the disinformation. It starts with the narrative first. They already create a crisis. They say something happens, and then they go and try and manufacture this evidence on the ground. So it's like creating facts on the ground.
This is a very dense report that we've been talking about from New Africa Institute, once again titled Disinformation in Tigray, Manufacturing Consent for a Secessionist War. Anything else, Simon?
Yes, I would like to say that what is going on right now in the Horn of Africa can have an enormous impact on the world right now, because I just want people to know that there is a genuine resistance bloc that is forming, and some are now calling the new Horn of Africa. This Horn of Africa where people are standing up and saying no to the tyranny of imperialism and, you know, super exploitation by the United States and Western governments. We just want to live in peace. And right now, because everybody is seeing what the United States and what the West has been doing, intervening and meddling and supporting TPLF, and continues to do so, shoving foreign force down our throats. And what the people are saying is no, we're saying no. And because we're saying no, and we're doing it so vocally, and they continue to push TPLF upon us, it's just radicalizing us and exposing who the United States is and how it operates. And I think that the world should get behind, especially progressive forces, should get behind the peoples of the Horn of Africa. We need this support before they ramp up a Libya-style humanitarian intervention war against the peoples of the Horn of Africa. And if you lose the Horn of Africa, that means the United States then again controls the Horn of Africa, or it's, you know, it'll be outside of the control of anyone. And, you know, that'll be a major loss for the world, because I believe that, again, this part of the world is the most conflicted and the poorest part of the world. So what happens when the poorest part of the world stands on its 2 feet? I truly believe if you are the type of person that believes in going to the low, the, you know, the, those who are the most exploited and lifting them up, you will lift up the world. I truly believe it. And so that's my message.
And that was Simon Tesfamariam, Eritrean American medical professional and executive director of New Africa Institute. We talked about the publication of a new report by this think tank titled Disinformation in Tigray, Manufacturing Consent for a Secessionist War. For Pacifica, I'm Paulina Vasiliev.
That was Ethiopian artist Teddy Afro. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Ann Garrison. Despite Ethiopia's internal conflict and external threats, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, the largest hydroelectric power project in Africa and the seventh largest in the world, is expected to begin producing power later this year. The dam promises to lift Ethiopia's subsistence farming majority from poverty, make Ethiopia a regional powerhouse, and deliver electricity to neighboring nations. However, the dam is under heavy military guard due to a 10-year dispute with Sudan and Egypt over water rights to the Blue Nile River, which flows downstream from Ethiopia's Lake Tana to Sudan, Egypt, and the Mediterranean. In one of President Trump's last reckless moments in office, he threatened to help Egypt blow up the dam. Last week, the UN Security Council met to consider a draft resolution put forth by Egypt and Sudan that would call on Ethiopia to halt the second seasonal filling of the dam underway now. Everyone called for a return to African Union negotiations despite a 10-year impasse, but statements made by the Egyptian and Sudanese foreign ministers and then the Ethiopian Minister of Water and Irrigation weren't altogether conciliatory.
All that Egypt has called for and sought is a binding agreement that includes an insurance policy against the harmful impacts of the GERD on Egypt's water security by designing a mechanism through which our three countries could cooperate to collectively bear the burden of addressing future periods of droughts. Unfortunately, however, Ethiopia remains steadfast in its rejection of any form of agreement that provides any meaningful measure of protection to the interests of downstream states. For us, the harm that the GERD might inflict will affect every aspect of the lives of the Egyptian people like a malignant plague. In the absence of an agreement that regulates its filling and operation, the GERD can cause cumulative water shortages in Egypt amounting to 120 billion cubic meters. It will diminish access to clean drinking water. It could deprive millions of farmers of the water they use to irrigate their fields. It will rob countless families of their income and livelihood. It will destroy thousands of acres of arable land. It will increase desertification and degrade the riparian ecosystem. And it will increase vulnerability to the effects of climate change. This is a situation that Egypt cannot and will not tolerate.
Her Excellency, Ms. Maryam Al-Sadiq Al-Mahdi, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Sudan.
President, we dearly hope that the Council will assume its responsibilities in maintaining regional peace and security in a preventative way by strengthening and stepping up negotiations under the auspices of the African Union. I should like to say unequivocally that this issue is a just cause. You are called, ladies and gentlemen, to promote a process which continues to meet obstacles, and you can help this process easily, freely, by freeing the courageous people of Sudan from their current suffering, by ensuring that the filling and functioning of the Renaissance Dam happens pursuant to a legally binding agreement. However, silence from the Council would send out the wrong message and would signify a tacit approval of the fact that this unilateral filling was acceptable. His Excellency Mr. Seleshi Bekele Aulachu, Minister of Water, Irrigation and Energy of Ethiopia. You have the floor.
Mr. President, colonialism and colonial treaties thwarted Africa's ability to utilize its natural resource for the benefit of its people. The Nile Basin countries have recognized this problem and worked towards addressing it. In 1999, we established the Nile Basin Initiative, and in 2010, we adopted the Cooperative Framework Agreement, or CFA, on the Nile after 13 years of negotiations. The insatiable demands of Egypt and most recently Sudan are not about the most issue of the GERD, but about the future development projects in Ethiopia and the other riparian countries. Without an effective CFA and regional mechanism, similar application will inevitably come to this council. Today it is Ethiopia's dam, tomorrow it will be any one of the Nile Basin countries. The Nile belongs to all the people of the basin countries. All the half a billion of us in the 11 riparian countries, and the water is enough for all of us. In this regard, we urge our Egyptian and Sudanese brothers and sisters to understand that a resolution to the Nile issue will not come from the Security Council. It can only come from good faith negotiations with due care for the well-being and development of each other. Ethiopia looks forward to continuing the AU-led trilateral negotiation on the GERD. We have the solution at hand, and we can herald good news to the world by concluding a mutually acceptable outcome. Finally, Mr. President, allow me to respectfully request the Council to return this matter to the able and legitimate leadership of the African Union and encourage Egypt and Sudan to seriously and faithfully negotiate to reach a negotiated settlement on the first filling and annual operations of the GERD. We also request the Council to make this meeting the last of its deliberation on the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. There is no subject matter as far from the mandate of the Council as this one. I thank you.
The UNSC may vote on the resolution this week, but deadlock between the five permanent members with veto power is all but certain. I spoke with Mohamed Bashir, a civil engineering professor at the University of Manchester, about the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Mohamed Bashir, first, I believe your training is civil engineering, and you teach that subject there at the University of Manchester. Is that correct?
Yes, my training is civil engineering, but I'm specialized in water resources management. So we look at how water resources can be used the best way possible. And part of that is building dams and operating dams. But my focus is on research. I only do research.
Okay. And what's the name of the school there where you teach?
The Mechanical Aerospace and Civil Engineering Department at the University of Manchester.
Okay, great. And are you or your family originally from Ethiopia or elsewhere in the Horn or the region?
Yes, I'm originally from Sudan.
Okay, I want to make it clear, I didn't ask that question with any mistrust about how scientifically you're approaching this. I just thought we should be upfront about it, given all the international tensions over the dam.
Yeah, that's okay. No problem. Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, I contacted you after reading a BBC article on the dam titled River Nile Dam, Why Ethiopia Can't Stop It Being Filled, which quoted you. It said that Egypt and Sudan's accusations against Ethiopia give the false impression that filling up the dam is like filling up a bath and that Ethiopia can turn a tap on and off at will. They quote you saying, for one, that given the stage that the construction is at, engineering-wise, physics-wise, there is no way to stop the filling now until the water level reaches the top of the dam wall. Is that an accurate quote?
Yes, that's an accurate quote, yes.
Okay, so does that mean that once the rainy season begins, the dam starts filling?
Yeah, so the way the dam has been designed is to fill up as it's being constructed. So what happened in the past few years is that Ethiopia has been building the two sides of the dam, so the left and right sides, and left the middle side open, the middle part open. That means now they're building up this middle part of the dam during the dry season. That's when the flow of water is low. That's normally between November and June. So during that time, the river flow can be passed through the outlets of the dam. But once the flood season starts from July to September, that's a peak of the flood season, then the outlets will not have the capacity to pass the high flows of the flood season. That means automatically the reservoir will start filling up until the water level of the reservoir reaches the height of the middle wall, and then water will start flowing over the wall. So that means because the outlets of the dam are too small to pass the entire flood wave, the reservoir will be filling up. In other words, because the wall is now constructed, there's no way to stop the filling from happening. So the reservoir will start filling at least until or up to the level of the middle wall, and then water will start flowing over the wall.
Does that mean over the wall into Sudan?
Yes, that means into Sudan, yeah. Downstream to Sudan and then to Egypt.
Okay. Egypt and Sudan have a resolution under consideration at the UN Security Council, which demands that Ethiopia stop the second filling of the dam. Does that make any sense in this circumstance?
Physically, it's not possible to stop the filling, as I just explained. The decision to carry on with the filling in this second year of the filling has already been taken a long time ago by Ethiopia when that middle wall was being raised.
Okay, so it's not really possible to stop the second filling of the dam now, but it is possible to negotiate agreements about management of the dam.
Yeah, and here we're talking about only the second year of the filling. The filling will still continue in the next few years. So I think what Sudan, Ethiopia, and Egypt needs to work on is an agreement for the subsequent years and then also for the long-term operation.
The dam is already producing some electricity, isn't it?
No, not yet. There needs to be a certain amount of water behind the reservoir to start generating electricity, but this is expected to happen this year.
Sudan and Egypt said they want to stop the second filling of the dam. So do you think that's a misunderstanding of the engineering?
No, I think they both know that the filling cannot be stopped now. In fact, in press conferences in the past week that the Sudanese water minister has given, he stated that the filling cannot be stopped now, and the decision to fill the dam has already been taken when Ethiopia started building that middle wall. So they know the engineering of the dam. They know that the filling cannot be stopped. I think what they are trying to do here is to make a statement that the filling shouldn't have been carried out unilaterally. But Ethiopia's decision to do that filling unilaterally was already taken back in April, May, when that middle wall was being built.
Some say that Egypt, and in turn Sudan, are not really concerned about their share of the Nile waters, but about the possibility that Ethiopia will rise to become a regional power rivaling Egypt. Does that make any sense to you as a civil engineer?
No, it actually does not. I think both Egypt and Sudan would benefit from a stronger Ethiopia, a more stable Ethiopia, more economically strong Ethiopia, because the ties between these three countries are quite strong. And both Sudan and Egypt expressed their support for Ethiopia's development and Ethiopia's use of the Nile water resources. I think the issue of Sudan and Egypt with the dam is they want to have certain assurances about their water security. The problem with the dam is different for Egypt and for Sudan. For Sudan, what they want to know is how the dam will be operated, because the dam is very, very close to Sudan. So they want to have a mechanism for exchanging data and making sure that there are certain rules to govern changes in flows from one day to the next, and etc. A lot of other technical details. For Sudan, there are also some concerns until now, because I think Sudan hasn't received any final documents on the dam safety. So there are some documents that need to be provided also to Sudan. This has not been provided yet. And there are also some missing studies on the socioeconomic and environmental impacts of the dam. For Egypt, what they worry about the most is how the dam would be operated during times of droughts. So that means if a drought happens like the one that happened in the 1980s, when we had multiple years with very low flows, then how much water is going to be released from the GERD, because that will impact the agriculture sector in Egypt, will impact employment and impact the economy of Egypt as well. And also the other concern is, following a drought, how will the reservoirs be recovered? Because typically after a drought, the reservoirs will be at a very low level. Now the question is, how fast will the GERD be filled up following a drought? Whether the GERD is going to be filled faster compared to the Aswan High Dam, which is also a very large dam located in Egypt. So these are completely different issues, I think, for the two countries. And I think these are the concerns of the countries, but I believe both Sudan and Egypt are not against the development of Ethiopia.
That's good to hear. We constantly hear the word famine associated with Ethiopia. Two words are almost irrevocably identified because of the great famines of previous decades and the massive charitable efforts to respond to them. Would the GERD be one of the best ways of protecting Ethiopia against famine in the future?
So the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, it's a hydropower dam, and it's located next to the border with Sudan. That means it is used for hydropower generation only. Of course, it will provide hydropower for Ethiopia's different sectors and would enable, of course, the development of the economy. But again, it doesn't provide water for irrigation or for other purposes. So it wouldn't protect from famine in that sense, because the GERD does not provide water for agriculture.
Okay. Possibly the electricity could be used to power irrigation systems. So does that make sense?
Yeah, that could be one way to look at it. So because electricity is an input to many, many activities in the economy, they can be used as well to pump water from groundwater to power food production and so on. But the impact is indirect, so it's not directly from the GERD, but through the hydropower that the GERD generates.
Okay, last year, according to the BBC, Sudan was taken by surprise when Ethiopia shut three of the four diversion outlets for the water. This led to lower levels downstream, which disrupted Sudan's pumping stations for irrigation and municipal water supply. If that's true, then it does seem that Sudan and Egypt have legitimate concerns about their share of the Blue Nile waters, no?
Yeah, last year Egypt didn't have any problems because the flow was very high. And Egypt has the Aswan High Dam, which has a huge water volume that can be used to mitigate any reductions in the Nile flow as a result of GERD filling, at least in the short term. For Sudan, the situation is different because the GERD is located very, very close to Sudan. There's no large reservoir in Sudan that is capable of storing a lot of water. So what happened last year is when the filling started, three of the gates were closed and only one was open, which resulted in a sharp drop in the river flow. And that resulted in also a sharp drop in river water levels. And that left a lot of the inlets of pumping stations along the Blue Nile out of command. That means they cannot abstract water anymore because they are out of the river. And that resulted in drinking water supply stations going out of service. That could have been avoided if there was clear communication of information with Ethiopia about the filling process, how much water will be released, when the filling was going to be started. Sudan could have taken some measures to mitigate that. But because there was no exchange of information and because that process was taken completely unilaterally, Sudan wasn't aware of that, and that caused the damage. So one of the lowest level of coordination in transboundary rivers is exchange of information. And if that was available, Sudan wouldn't have suffered from the first year filling.
Okay. The UN Security Council is considering this as a matter of war and peace. And in one BBC report, they said there's really nothing Egypt can do about this now unless it wants to go to war with Ethiopia, a horrible prospect. Or do you think that can be avoided?
Definitely war is the worst solution. And it's not a solution because it creates more problems than it solves. I believe nothing that war can provide cannot be gained from talks and negotiations. So I think there is absolutely no need to go into war for negotiations over water or over this dam. The talks and negotiations are fully capable of resolving this issue. And I don't think the countries would go to that solution.
The other day you told me that the U.S. and Mexico had renegotiated the treaty regarding the Colorado River Basin 300 times, and that something like that kind of cooperation is needed here. Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah, so one of the concerns of Ethiopia is that if they enter into a binding agreement, it might constrain their use of the river in the future. And indeed, if, for example, if they commit to releasing certain water volumes to the downstream, then they will have to continue doing that, and that will impact the way water is used in the upstream. Now, there are solutions that have been done elsewhere in other river basins in the world, and there's an example from the Colorado River Basin. There was a treaty between the U.S. and Mexico, the management of the river, and they actually introduced changes to this treaty in minutes. So they meet, they write meeting minutes, and then they add them to the agreement. And that has been done quite a lot. And that could be an example which Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt can follow in addressing Ethiopia's concerns. So they could negotiate now about the GERD, but they could also be open to meeting again in the future when Ethiopia decides to go on with their further plans and then come up with new minutes and add them to the agreement. So the idea is to have flexibility, legal flexibility, to allow accommodating future uncertainties.
And both the human and climatic situations are fluid, right?
Yeah, that's right. So we still don't know how climate change is going to impact the Nile flow. So some studies show that climate change will increase the Nile flows. Some studies show that it will decrease the Nile flows. So all these factors will need to be taken into account as they unfold. Again, there are also uncertainties around population growth, around how the countries will take into economic development. All these are going to impact the demand for water resources in the region. And this should have to be taken into account, or at least we should have the flexibility to accommodate these changes in any agreement over Nile water management.
So the three countries have to negotiate and continue negotiating well into the future, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I think what they need to do is to try to think a little bit creatively. So instead of trying to figure out ways to share the water resources, I think they should start thinking about sharing the benefits that the water resources would generate. And this is a very well-known concept now in river basin management. It's called sharing benefits, because each of the countries has different potentials and different resources. Ethiopia has high hydropower potential. Sudan has large agricultural potential. Egypt has expertise and long history in agriculture and agriculture-related industries. So if all these aspects were brought together in a collaborative framework, then the Nile water would be enough for everyone to obtain the benefits that they want.
Okay, now I've done my best trying to make sense of this, not being an engineer. Is there anything else you think we should understand that I haven't touched on?
No, I think we covered pretty much all the points. But again, I mean, the last thing maybe I want to finish with is negotiations is the way to solve this. But the three countries need to figure out different ways to negotiate, because the negotiations have been going on for over 10 years now, and there's still no solution. That means the negotiations need to be set up differently and reach a solution as soon as possible.
Okay, Mohamed Bashir, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Karna yom no dibe karani radepno sila numademna malif galmange nyu karan nu kavemo garada la maf gauda tapne dune kumadamne elamiko amho gami o
That was Ethiopian Oromo singer, songwriter, and civil rights activist Hachalu Hundessa. His music was central to ethnic Oromo protests, which contributed to the downfall of the last TPLF Prime Minister, Hailemariam Desalegn, in 2018. Hundessa's 2020 assassination caused widespread protest among the Oromo ethnic group and across Ethiopia. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all producers who contribute to this weekly show. I produced today's episode with Polina Vasiliev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. You can find this and all other episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.